Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about how the laws don't seem to pertain to many elites, collusion between police and city attorneys, and the newest toy bought by the military-industrial complex. But before we can move on, well, after 30,000 emails and dozens of interviews conducted, the FBI has decided not to seek prosecution of Hillary Clinton for using her personal email server to handle classified documents. Here is FBI Director James Comey.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. We believe our investigation has been sufficient to give us reasonable confidence there was no intentional misconduct. In looking back at our investigations into the mishandling or removal of classified information, we cannot find a case that would support bringing criminal charges on these facts.
Well, it's worth noting on a side note that Director Comey also highly and extremely reckless by pushing this idea of the Ferguson effect. But be that as it may, his announcement was fairly harsh. And Comey noted that there was, quote, evidence to support a conclusion that Clinton knew that the email server itself was not kosher. And he then goes on to lay out that because there was no specific intent to use the server to send classified emails, that the investigation itself couldn't recommend a prosecution. It's worth noting here that in the State Department Inspector General's report, when staffers raised the issue of the email server not being set up properly, they were told it wasn't an issue and to, quote, never speak of the secretary's personal email server again, end quote. Further, Secretary Clinton never sought any sort of approval or authorization for this email server, even though it was pretty clear, I think, to everyone that it had strong potential to violate department norms. And in other words, it's clear Hillary Clinton was fully aware that classified information could be mishandled in the process and wasn't really looking to have her personal email server scrutinized. And there clearly is a sense of impunity at the top when it comes to secrecy. Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus get let off with no real punishment for mishandling classified information, while others are ruthlessly punished. For instance, Jeffrey Sterling had no real evidence against him, yet was imprisoned for allegedly leaking CIA documents. Edward Snowden did what even a former attorney general has called a public service and is on the run. Chelsea Manning actually revealed government wrongdoing and is facing the toughest sentence ever handed down to a whistleblower. And you may say, well, they leaked evidence. Clinton didn't. Nevertheless, she left it vulnerable to be stolen, which is pretty close to the same thing in my opinion. But if we really want to make that point about leaking things, let's not forget the Obama administration gave up quite a bit of classified info to Catherine Bigelow to make Zero Dark 30. It seems the higher you go in the U.S. government, the more immune you are to prosecution. And concealed evidence in a Chicago police brutality trial has unearthed a massive new find that cities all across the country have routinely engaged in the practice of hiding evidence to defend police officers. The investigation by the AP into hundreds of court documents found it to be a routine practice in police brutality civil suits to hide evidence to attempt to protect officers from liability. From Chicago to Denver, Spokane, Washington to Washington, D.C., to New York City and Baltimore, the AP found clear evidence of misconduct by city attorneys. In the Chicago lawsuit that broke this issue wide open, a federal trial revealed that the police concealed audio files that showed they lied about having some sort of probable cause to stop Darius Penix, which they did not, just before they shot him dead. The family of Penix reached a financial settlement agreement with the city on June 3rd, and while the officers are cleared of legal trouble in this instance, more cases are almost certainly on their way. In another Chicago case, a man was falsely arrested, then his mother's home was illegally searched. And while the case itself collapsed under its own weight, it was only after the trial the police revealed they had evidence all along that the arrest and search were illegal. In yet another false arrest case, the attorneys for the city of Chicago said that the key evidence in this case was lost or destroyed. When the judge pressed them on the veracity of this claim, they then found the evidence in 15 minutes. As one Chicago attorney put it, and I quote, The city has a clear, widespread practice of destroying and lying about unfavorable evidence. Which, of course, is pretty easy to believe because this is the same police department that operated a black site and had a decades-long torture ring. It was not, as we've just said, though, simply Chicago. For instance, on June 6th of this year, a judge in New York State said she found it, quote, astounding that New York City officials claimed key evidence didn't exist in the case of Jabbar Campbell, who was beaten by police while hosting a gay pride party. The same judge went on to say that the behavior of the New York City attorneys was a, quote, pattern of willful failure to turn over key documents. Spokane, Washington, in 2006, a janitor with developmental disabilities, Otto Zim, was buying a soda in a convenience store he often visited. Operating off of a false report, Officer Carl Thompson rushed into the store and within 16 seconds was beating Zim with a baton, including blows to the head, then tasered him multiple times, then illegally hogtied him on the ground and placed a mask over his face, and that very quickly led to his death. Police tampered with the video to try to get the officer off, and not surprisingly, a more thorough investigation found that the city attorney also tampered with evidence in the criminal trial. And in case you thought it was all about police killings, AP also noted that Washington, D.C. for years sat on thousands of records that proved unconstitutional, sometimes brutal behavior towards protesters to try to protect themselves from liability. The judge in that case noted that the misconduct was systematic and, quote, shocking. So despite the constant claims that the police should be given the benefit of the doubt in shootings and brutality cases, here we are again with glaring evidence to the contrary. Congress is about to give the Navy a $475 million ship it doesn't want that most likely does not work. Yes, that's right. $475 million on something the Pentagon says it doesn't need and that performance reviews say is of iffy value at best. In the new defense spending bill set to be passed in the coming days, Congress has decided to insert funding for a third littoral combat ship, or LCS, beyond the two the Pentagon requested for this year. This is part of the overall order of 40 that was already cut by military officials from an envisioned 52. Why is the Pentagon attempting to shed itself of some of these ships, you may ask? Well, in the words of their own performance review, quote, the ship is not reliable. This would be like reading a Yelp review for a sushi restaurant where 535 people gave a half-star review because the fish is rotten and, hey, may not actually be fish. But you still go ahead and order $475 million worth of sushi from said restaurant. Sounds crazy, right? Well, it's less crazy than you think, because in this year's defense budget, there are literally billions of dollars in appropriations that the Pentagon does not want. The House bill has $6.7 billion in unasked for defense spending, which is actually more than the $4.6 billion in unwanted spending actually passed by Congress last year. The Senate decided to be a little more modest and is asking only for $4.3 billion in spending for stuff the Pentagon is saying it does not want to be given. As one researcher puts it, Congress wants to pass out the cash and look like they're being strong on defense. The case of the literal combat ship, our $475 million unwanted gift, shows how this kind of thing happens. Despite the ship faring terribly in sea trials and living up to no promises, the Navy told Congress, yeah, we want more of that, despite the Pentagon itself saying clearly it didn't work. Why? Well, believe it or not, because it could be worth a whole lot of money. Large numbers of former military officials get very lucrative jobs at military contractors once they retire or leave the service, which creates a huge incentive to maximize the profit of the contractors while they're in the service. This is why consistently the U.S. military services push things that they clearly don't need and that clearly do not work. Congress initially made sure that the LCS is being built by two separate companies, two separate shipyards, maximizing the potential bounty to military contractors. How much money? The overall life cycle of this program is $45 billion, a veritable gold mine. As soon as the Pentagon started intimating it wanted to cut the failing program, the companies got to work. The two companies, Austal USA and Lockheed Martin, spent millions on lobbying and employed lobbyists, almost all of whom are former employees of the government, either on, wait for it, the same committees they were lobbying, the Navy, the Department of Defense. They also, over the years, have been making millions of donations to various congresspeople. So to reiterate, you have the contractors who want the money, the officers in the Navy who want jobs from contractors, and congressmen and women who want the jobs and pork barrel spending to help them with the voters and the campaign donations to help them with their opponents. So combine all that, and you get somewhere between $4 to $6 billion in entirely unrequested defense funding. And these funds include all sorts of things, including often hundreds of millions of dollars in unspecified funding for National Guard projects, which is an easy way for Congress and the military to dole out the pork barrel spending. This is exactly why President Eisenhower warned of the military-industrial congressional complex. And now we can add to that the new massive overlay of the national security state and the circular incentives we see between all these various officials feeding at the money trough to push more and more programs, policies, and weapons has sent us down a dark spiral of, in the military's own words, waste, fraud, and abuse. While communities are starved of funds for necessary social programs, the champagne keeps flowing for the weapons makers. While neither Hillary Clinton nor Donald Trump is willing to say it, the social crisis here at home can't be solved without dismantling the military machine. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And to continue this conversation, we are very happy to be joined by Stuart Anderson, founder and executive director of Family and Friends of Incarcerated People. I usually get that backwards. And by phone, the Reverend Asafego Huru-Seku, a pastor, writer, organizer, and musician currently on tour with his band, Reverend Seku and the Holy Ghost. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here with you, Gene.
It's an honor.
Excellent. And Stu, let me just start with you and reflecting off a little bit of what we were just talking about in the talking points. You know, looking at this issue of Congress giving the military money for things it doesn't want. I mean, beyond that fact in and of itself, how do you react to the fact that the ship doesn't work, yet they're still going to spend $45 billion on it regardless?
That's appalling. It is crazy to know that something that you are pouring money into does not work. It's like the prison industrial complex itself. We continue to pour money into incarcerating people and confining people and separating and ripping people away from their loved ones and their friends, thinking that that's the answer. And so this idea of funding this project for a ship that they clearly have said, their own specialists, that this is not a workable project. So for them to continue to push this agenda without seriously saying, hold up, okay, if our own experts are telling us that this is a waste of resources, then why, I ask, is the government still pushing the agenda?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a good point. And Reverend Seku, feel free to weigh in on why, but I just wonder how you feel when you see the sticker shock from $45 billion for a ship that does not work.
I mean, well, the realities are that this is just, I would disagree with my dear brother and say, actually, it does work, that the system is working just fine in terms of the ways in which global capital has used one of its primary trading commodities is in terms of militarism. So whether it be oil or whether it be war machines, that the reality is that this is about generating capital, particularly for the defense industry, which is completely entrenched within the political structure of our time. And we saw that explicitly with the role that Blackwater, David Rumsfeld, and the others played in their relationship to the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Stu.
Reverend Seku, so you're saying that it works for the profiteers. Okay, all right, now I follow you completely. I'm about to jump in there, right, and stop you. Say, hold up, how you going to disagree with me, man? This thing's not working for, it's not working for the taxpayer. It's not working for the common people, you know.
Right. It's working just fine for the folks it's supposed to work with.
That's right.
Which says for us that the conversation then can't simply be about tinkering with the democracy, right? It can't simply about, you know, whether it be in our struggle. It's not simply about making police act better, but it's about what is the very nature of policing. Why do we have them in their community? why in our communities, why do they exist? Same thing with the prison industrial complex. It's not simply about a more humane form of mass incarceration. So it's just it's about the very existence of the system of itself, which is at stake in our conversation.
And Stu, in 1 minute, tell me what you think about Reverend Sekou laying the goals down, or maybe how we should define them right there.
I like exactly what Reverend Sekou has said about everything. And I'm glad to be clear that that's the position that he took up. You know, one of the things I did over the early summer, well, late spring, was I worked with this whole push by Democracy Spring about taking money out of politics. And so this is exactly a reason why we need to be taking money out of politics, because as long as money drives the political scheme of things, then we have a situation where we have politicians pushing ideas like the creation of this ship that does not work for the public safety as it is being laid out there. So I love the way that he laid that out there.
Absolutely. And Reverend Sekou, I'm curious, and we have about 30 seconds before the first break here. I mean, what do you think? Can we say the same thing about the system working exactly how it's supposed to when it comes to this issue of these city attorneys hiding this evidence?
Yes. The nature is that if we are trafficking in the currency of democracy, then the nation is morally bankrupt.
Mm.
And that so the reality is that there should be separation between the prosecutors and the police and the judges, that there should be a separation of powers in that framework so that everyone can equally do their job. But what happens in that context is that they begin to function as a managerial class.
Mm-hmm. And with that, we're going to take a break, but we're going to come back to this with Stuart Anderson and Reverend Sekou. You're listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking a little bit about ideology in the Black Lives Matter movement, or movement for Black Lives, generational divides within and between movements, and the chances of people of color closing some of the historical divides between them. And we are very happy to be carrying this conversation on with Stuart Anderson, founder and executive director of Family and Friends of Incarcerated People, and Reverend Uhuru Sekou, a pastor, writer, organizer, and musician, currently on tour with his band, Reverend Sekou and the Holy Ghost. I got a little excited when I said that. I was listening to your music earlier, Reverend, and we were definitely rocking out here in the office. But where we left off is you were talking a little bit about this idea of the criminal justice system and the things that are broken within it, not being a misfunction or malfunction of the system, but the way it should be working.
I mean, and part of it is the way in which the American government has been a feature of global capitalism, which is in a crisis. And that crisis in global capital demands that new markets are open. And one of the new markets that is being opened is the market, well, the continuation and the expansion of that market, whether it be financialization, you know, through these subprime loans and that kind of thing, as well as the military industrial complex and the defense industry is a part of structuring those market variables in such a way that people can generate maximum profit while trafficking in the currency of national hysteria.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stu, let me ask you a slightly separate question here. And, you know, I wonder, you know, it's interesting to me, at least, you know, you look at this election season and you've got sort of the whole movement for Black Lives essentially either, you know, sort of abstaining from endorsing people and just doing movement work. And then, you know, a handful of people gathered behind Bernie. Yet the whole Congressional Black Caucus was behind Clinton. And so I wonder, do you view beyond just the issues at stake in the movement for Black Lives, is this an emergence of like a new Black leadership in America?
Coming out of Black Lives Matter?
Yeah.
I think that it is provocative and pivotal at this moment that we have a surge of Black masses and, more importantly, Black folk under the age of 30. Who are now speaking out on the political landscape. And so from this surge in response to police aggression, I think that we do eventually come to heads with a number of individuals who will be equipped to lead the black masses from a perspective of blackness, as opposed to having someone like our friend on the Supreme Court.
I hear you. And Reverend Sekou, let me ask you this. I mean, obviously, you know, I feel free to weigh in on whether or not you think this split, maybe if you can even call it that, between Movement for Black Lives and CBC as a new leadership. But I also wonder what you think, too, about this issue. I mean, a lot of people say it's a generational thing. It's young versus old. I mean, is it really generational that's dividing people, or is it political and ideological?
I think the divide is primarily an ideological divide. It often plays itself out along generational lines, meaning that like, for instance, take the term black power. Many of the folks of this generation would trace part of their radicality to the legacy of radical in terms of the kind of mainstream myth about the divide among, say, integrationists and black power advocates, right, which is, you know, that needs to be nuanced and teased out a little bit because it doesn't play itself out that neatly. But just for the sake of argument, taking at face value the myth around those two constructions, right? But the term black power itself, that Nixon had a black power summit in his White House, right, deploying the term black power,
right,
and that black power in and of itself was conflated with black capitalist advancement, right? So it was a pro-capitalist formation. Now, the author of the book Black Power and the person who popularized the phrase, Mukasa, then Willie Ricks, the first person to yell Black Power, Kwame Ture wound up popularizing it, formerly Stokely Carmichael wound up popularizing it. But that is who was, and Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, was a socialist. He was a Pan-African socialist.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so would have been opposed using black power as a moniker to give covering to bourgeois black aspirations within that context.
I agree with that 100%.
Right. That's the same thing with Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is a term, when lifted from its political context, can be deployed with neoliberal sensibility, given that is the dominant form of both ideology and legislative practice in the context of the United States of America in late modernity. Right, that's the nature of the right. So it usually extracts words, it uses them, and deploys them in such a way as an existential intervention into the discourse that then it ultimately leaves meaning. So
right.
Black Lives Matter can leave meaning very much like the words change and hope.
Sure.
It could be flattened out.
Right. And Stuart, I know you want to jump in, so go ahead.
One of the things I wanted to say in response to what you were saying, and I agree with the idea that what Nixon did and how they tried to popularize and attach this black power and its resurgence to this capitalist idea. I can say here in D.C., from my conversations with some of those individuals who are identified kind of loosely as leaders inside the movement here, the Black Lives Movement here, there is a conscious effort to operate against that idea. There's a conscious effort to ensure that it is not co-opted in such a fashion that it does exactly what you have said has happened in the past with the Black Power Movement. And so Black Lives Matter personnel that I'm in direct contact with here in D.C., I'd like to say, are individuals who clearly are aware of how ideas can be co-opted and spent and popularized and then capitalized.
And Stuart, let me follow up with you on one question, too, because when we're talking about sort of new leadership emerging, I mean, you were family and friends of incarcerated persons. You're also someone who was at one time incarcerated. There is now, I mean, there's a lot of prison strikes going on across the country, as they call them in Washington, D.C., returning citizens and other places formerly incarcerated people are starting to become more prominent in asserting their rights. I mean, is that also a part of this moment that from the millennial point of view, some new folks are rising up, but that also formerly incarcerated and some incarcerated people are also a part of this new awakening and this new leadership emerging in Black America?
That's correct. One of the phenomenal things I see happening with, and largely we're calling ourselves returning citizens But I'd add also those who are saying ex-offender, who are still saying ex-offender and things of that nature, that there are efforts to meet. And there have been large meetings of returning citizens from all across the country, as far away as California, as far north as New York and Connecticut and Houston. And so there is an effort to galvanize a strong collective body of individuals to address the three evils that King clearly talked about that has been plaguing American society for black folks since its advent. So, yes, there is a place and has been kind of like, I mean, there are individuals inside the Black Lives Matter contingency that are often reaching into the returning citizen population for its leadership to be a part of and to speak to truth to power.
No, absolutely. And you know, Reverend Sekou, the other question that I have in some degree, too, is also about sort of the strategy and the tactics of the movement. And, you know, maybe that plays into ideology. I mean, you know, part of it, I mean, it almost seems like there's an enforced submissiveness in Black America where, I mean, we just passed July 4th here, which is, you know, a holiday celebrating, you know, violent, bloody revolution, guns, killing people. It's celebrated by making all these great peons to these massive war machines, including, you know, B-2 bombers that can drop nuclear weapons. Yet protesters are told, you know, don't ever do anything other than stand somewhere with a sign. But the results that we often see coming have come in the wake of mass uprisings in Ferguson and in Baltimore. So, I mean, I guess, am I right that there is an enforced submissiveness on Black people in America? And should we start to look more at what gets results than what we're being told to do?
So to answer your question, yes, right. But at the same time, that the question for me is the question of ideology, right? And so, right, so there is the neoliberal option, which is the most dominant and popular form that is associated with Black Lives Matter, right? So when you look at Campaign Zero, right, which is primarily a neoliberal a set of policies, right, that have emerged out of the work that many nonprofits have been doing and are coalescing and correlating them together. Right. So the neoliberal option is about tinkering with a system, meaning changing the police behavior versus changing the very nature of policing and the very nature of police. Right. Then you have more liberal formations like Color of Change. Right. That's a liberal formation that is often attacks targets who have engaged in egregious forms of disrespect. Moreover, it has been key in raising the names of Black women who've been subject to the arbitrary violence of the state and moving that forward, but as a neoliberal configuration. Then you have actual radical, if not revolutionary formations, which is the Black Lives Matter Network, right, which I'm making distinction from the discourse and organization, which has at the center of it a kind of queer, womanist, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, abolition position on prisons, right? And that radical formation is what the leading edge is that has created the space for the liberal and the neoliberal formation. And that radical edge emerges from the ground because it is in part responding to the uprising of everyday people, particularly in Ferguson, right? And so I frame it this way in my limited Christian language. If Black Lives Matter is the word, then Ferguson is the word made flesh.
Yeah. As the son of a preacher, I can appreciate that for sure. But go ahead, continue.
So what that means then, what are the possibilities of maintaining a radical edge in which everyday people serve as the impetus and the guide while you have cross-class collaboration in a way that attempts to radically transform the civilization?
Yeah.
And so Black Lives Matter as a network is positioned to do that. The challenge is that by creating the political space among the radical folks and the folks on the street in terms of both discursive practices and in the street practices, right, which many have done both.
Right, right. Well, and here's my follow-up, too, quickly to that, because I think this is an interesting point. I mean, you know, and when we talk about possibilities of maintaining a radical edge, I mean, it seems like one of the key things that we have to talk about, too, is state repression. And I feel like I haven't seen as much conflict. I mean, not people talk about state repression, but I haven't seen as much about, you know, quote-unquote self-defense or what people would call it. But I just wonder how you relate, you know, sort of the history of revolution, and this by any means necessary, Malcolm X, all revolutions are bloody, to the possibilities of people being repressed, to there needing to be a conversation about self-defense.
So So my position is that I am committed to a revolutionary nonviolence, right? But I do so have that conversation in the comfort of a bourgeois civilization that has offered some bourgeois reform, right? So I do it in context at least the illusion of constitutional restraint, right? That's part of the right. So in that context, now if I lived in Palestine, it might be a different conversation. I'd definitely be a stone thrower,
right? Right.
So in that, so in that context, right, that any conversation about nonviolence has to acknowledge a conversation that we do so in the context of the United States of America with the plausibility, not always practicality, not always operated that way. That's what we saw in America. We saw in the streets of Ferguson that the Constitution didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's what state of emergencies are about. They're about eradicating the protection among citizens for the possibilities of some restraint on the state.
I see Stuart Anderson chomping at the bit. So go ahead, get in on this. It's very substantive.
Let me say that in principle, the ideas laid down by Dr. King, I look at myself as being kind of a clone between King and Malcolm. And I look at Black Lives Matter and where they are and all of what is taking place across the country to get us from Ferguson to where we are now, all of the energy that drove us to that bubbling up. And I think that bubbling up is tantamount to some of the things that led to a 4th of July. You know, we just celebrated in this country, and I say we loosely, the 4th of July. What was that? It was an uprising. They call it a revolution. You know, lately, we've looked at Black Lives Matter and said that they were riots. Earlier, Reverend Sekou brought in words of Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, and these are things that he talked about in trying to explain his life in his book. And so I think that with everything that's happening, we have to educate people and teach people the six principles of nonviolence and everything. But as you said, if you were in Palestine, you'd definitely be a stone thrower. Yeah. Well, I tell you that Palestine has come to America.
No doubt about that. We are certainly in occupied territory. And as I always say to people all the time, you know, look at Indian independence, look at the Black Liberation Movement. I mean, you know, there's always a multiplicity of tactics and different things that are happening. But, you know, with that, that is going to be our time for today. But I want to give a very special thanks to Stuart Anderson and to Reverend Sekou. And I got to say, check out Reverend Sekou and the Holy Ghost, y'all. They are on Spotify, social media handles, RSHG. They are on tour right now. Reverend Sekou and the Holy Ghost, please check them out. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining, and thank you all for listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing to talk about the Clinton email scandal, whistleblowers, and chances for activists to maybe do a little more to take on Wall Street. And we are joined in this conversation by Abby Martin, who's a journalist and host of The Empire Files, a weekly investigative news program on Telesur English. Abby, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Eugene.
So I want to start with some of the fairly big news, maybe to be the biggest news of the week, and that is the fact that Hillary Clinton will not, in fact, be charged with any sort of crime in this email server issue. Are you surprised?
No, I'm not surprised at all. I think that, look, if this happened to anyone else on the campaign trail, they would have been out immediately. I think that everyone has dirt on them. Everyone commits crimes in this criminal system that we live in. But Hillary especially, I mean, the most powerful family arguably in D.C., look, the FBI knew that they could not indict her, especially when there's no candidate really other than her. The entire establishment's backing her. She's been chosen from the get-go. So I think that on one hand, it was obvious that she committed a crime. She knew exactly that the emails were classified. She had numerous briefings on them. It just shows you how arrogant she was, that she just didn't want to have the inconvenience of using two cell phones. So not surprised, although I'm always kind of surprised at just the lengths that the criminal establishment will go to protect its own.
Yeah, no, I mean, the thing that, you know, really shocked me, it wasn't in this, it was in the Inspector General's report, that two IT professionals in there were like, hey, maybe this email server issue is like not like kosher. And then they were told, never mention the secretary's private email server again. So obviously there was something to hide, but you know, and I guess there's quite a bit to be, you know, said about Hillary, and you've done this, you've explored some of this on your show. It just seems like she's often in these gray area type of situations. And one of the other sort of pieces where there's been a lot of conjecture, but no real, you know, no, I don't know, this discussion, but a lot of conjecture, is her ties to Wall Street. But she wouldn't release the transcripts on Goldman Sachs. And she's claiming at least that she is not unduly influenced at all by any of these Wall Street bankers. I mean, I wonder what you think about that. And from your own reporting, if you could sort of shed some light on some of these Wall Street ties and what's going on there.
No, it's hilarious. I mean, look, you need not see any more than who's backing these candidates to see who they're indebted to. I mean, Hillary Clinton's top five of her top 10 political donors since 1999 have been giant banks, including, of course, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, her two faves. Mm. I mean, her speeches alone, check this out. I mean, in 2013, right after leaving office as Secretary of State, of course, after harnessing all these connections, she made $3 million for giving 12 speeches to Wall Street. I mean, that amounts to $5 grand per minute. And I don't understand this kind of fake controversy about the transcripts being released, because we know what's in them.
Right.
We know what's in the transcripts. Right. They're obviously her praising banks and the banking establishment, because they wouldn't keep asking her back and paying her an outrageous amount of money to do so. So, you know, and her and Bill both have made $150 million in speaking fees, not only to banks, but just kind of elite think tanks, hedge funds, etc. So, you know, she is such a banking darling. It's not even funny. I mean, so much more than Bush. You have not only the entire neocon establishment backing her, but I mean, freaking Bush's Treasury Secretary, Paulson, is op-eds, Goldman Sachs CEO. You know, he's writing op-eds endorsing her. I mean, you know, something's very twisted.
Yeah, when something like that is, I mean, a dude that is, I mean, he is the bailout guy. I mean, he was the one who came up with it. And then people just kind of forget how these things happen. But he was the one who was going around shopping it on Capitol Hill and in the media, saying that the world was going to end if they didn't do that. I mean, I think it's an extraordinarily relevant situation. It also just makes you wonder how someone who's making $5,000 a minute giving these kind of speeches could, for some reason at all, think that there should only be like a $12 an hour minimum wage nationally. But I guess it speaks to how, you know, craven that she is. But, you know, we're talking about Hillary, and we're talking about a lot of the things that are, you know, maybe lesser known, and with Hillary, more and more is being known every day. But I think that there's a lot of sort of subsidiary issues here about the media landscape, people feeling like we're not getting enough. There's not great investigative coverage. And so I know you're doing this story. So I was hoping that you could just say a little bit more about what, you know, why is it that you have done this show, The Empire Files? What are you trying to do? What are you trying to reveal? And how does the work you've done around Clinton tie into that?
Well, you know, we're doing a weekly documentary and interview series. My partner, Mike, and I, we're basically covering a variety of issues through the lens of the U.S. empire, being the center, this looming militaristic hegemon, kind of the rest of the world standing under its shadow. It's meant to be educational for beginners who are coming to these issues, and it's also meant to be kind of provide this deeper analysis for people who are already familiar with these issues. So we've covered everything from the biggest prison system in history, of course, the U.S. of A, 5% of the world's population, 25% of its prisoners, to everything, to individual stories of people who have lived in the empire through the eyes of the oppressed and marginalized, like Ramona Africa, the sole survivor of the MOVE bombing in Philly. So interviews with insiders like James Risen, New York Times journalist, to Noam Chomsky, to just in-depth investigative reporting on the border situation. You know, everyone's talking about this kind of manic, xenophobic talking point galvanizing behind Trump. The most disturbing thing about it is that we have a border already. It is looming. It is militarized. It is insane. Where the border doesn't exist is a natural border. And that was a policy actually done under the Clintons in 1994, is prevention through deterrence. And before that policy was enacted, Eugene, a handful of migrants died crossing the border into our country. After that policy, thousands of migrants die every year in a virtual, literal graveyard on our border. And that was Clinton's doing. And Hillary supported militarizing the border up until very recently. So Trump is disgusting, his xenophobic rhetoric out this border, but we really have to look at the deeper issue here, and that this has been going on for a long time. So the Empire Files really, you know, when you're living in a country that is the world's strongest, most powerful empire, and it sounds like a conspiracy theory to even say the name, you know, to even say the word mm-hmm. empire and acknowledge the fact that we live in one, because we're so indoctrinated and conditioned with American exceptionalism that we think we have the moral arbitration to be an empire and to impose on the rest of the world. Kerry was just giving a speech at the Aspen Institute or some-ish, and he was basically boasting about how America's engaged in more places with greater impact today than at any other time in American history. By the end of last year, U.S. Special Ops had already been deployed 135 countries, Eugene. That's 70% of all the nations on the planet compared to 60 under Bush. It shows you that this empire is continuing, exacerbating, and it does not matter what party is in charge.
No, I hear you 100%. And you know, I really highly recommend people. I mean, all of them I think are great on Empire Files, but the one on the border is crazy. I mean, especially the piece about people, and maybe you could talk about this, people poisoning the water that is left out there for migrants. I mean, that's really happening, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Border Patrol, you know, first of all, there's people like, oh man, who Jan Brewer, you know, encouraging people to basically become militias and just police the border on their own. So there's already kind of that, like, you know, institutionalizing, like, that's okay to go just harass migrants. But there's also people who are vigilantes going to kill migrants. And then there's people employed by our tax dollars doing the same thing, knocking over water bottles. There's hidden camera footage of Border Patrol screaming at people leaving water bottles, slashing the water in front of them. And then these vigilantes go out and slash and dash. And then there's even photos of them actually hanging the water bottles like they're lynching them on trees. I mean, can you just imagine having no water and food for days coming across this in the desert? It's just the most inhumane, despicable thing I can ever imagine. It's basically killing them.
Right, right. No, I hear you. And I mean, one of the things you mentioned a little bit earlier is this James Risen story. I mean, you know, not only are a lot of these things happening, they're being censored. I just wondered if you could just touch on for our listeners a little bit what really took place in this James Risen case, who's a New York Times journalist. I think it's just totally outrageous.
It is totally outrageous. James Risen is a New York Times journalist, establishment as you can get. I mean, he was right at the top, you know, right embedded in DC. After seeing what his publication did to sell the Iraq War, of course, Judith Miller fallaciously pushing WMDs, Saddam trying to get his hands on a nuke, etc., a complete embarrassment for the New York Times. So James Risen, being an amazing journalist and with integrity, saw this happening, was given the information about the wiretapping story. So Stellar Wind, which was the warrantless wiretapping story in the Bush administration before, of course, the Snowden leaks vindicated all of this. He was given this from an insider. He wanted to put it on New York Times. They refused because Bush was threatening them at the time. Bush officials actually came to the office saying, the blood from the next terrorist attack will be on your hands. We're going to tell everyone it's the New York Times' fault if we have another terrorist attack. So, I mean, I'm not apologizing for the New York Times. It's insane for them not to publish the story, but that's the climate. That was the climate of stenography and fear shaping all these news publications in the wake of 9/11. So, of course, James kept pushing. He kept pushing. He said, let's publish it. They said no. After the 2004 election, he was like, let's do it now. If you guys were waiting for the election, let's get this story out there. This is unconstitutional. It's a crime. They said no. And so he just published it in his book, which was so freaking awesome. And he basically, right before his book came out, just told the New York Times, he was like, look, you might want to publish it now because I'm going to publish this in my book. So it's going to look really bad if you don't. They came under insane amount of heat. Bush tried to charge James Risen with Espionage Act back then, but it didn't stick. So from that point forward, he was basically under the radar, being spied on, God knows what else, from the Bush administration. It passed on over the Obama administration, where Obama did end up getting him for another story, kind of a similar story, where he was trying to expose some sabotage operation in Iran, which at the time, actually, the story came out during the Bush administration. At the time, it was really serious because we were trying to go to Iran based on another fallacious argument that they had a nuclear weapons program, which, of course, we know is not true. So at the time, James got information that not only did they not have a nuclear weapons program, but that the only nuclear weapons program that they could potentially have was given to them through like a CIA informant, and it was like a dubious blueprint. Mm-hmm. So it was just completely insane. So he was trying to get this story out, threatened again. New York Times wouldn't do it, so he put it out in his book. And of course, after that, all hell broke loose. his alleged source got charged with the Espionage Act. So that was the eighth person under Obama alone that has been charged with this archaic World War I legislation that was basically meant for spies, hasn't been resurrected until now. And James fought a subpoena. I mean, he was forced to testify. He didn't, of course, give any information about his source, and he was going to go to jail. But it basically ruined his life for 7 years. And that's what the government does. They hone in on you, they target you, and even if you haven't done anything wrong, really, if he's just doing his job, they will make your life a living hell. So he fought tooth and nail, and he finally came out victorious in this whole battle. It's an incredible thing. We just did a huge interview with him just about, you know, this kind of dichotomous culture of just anonymous sources in DC, where you have half the journalists, I would say actually a lot more than half, who just literally pal around, you know, go to the White House Correspondents Dinner, pal around with a bunch of government agents or foreign operatives and get planted these sources and stories to bolster themselves, you know, and to keep their access. And then you have the other half of, or a very few, select few, they're a dying breed, of course, like James, who will actually risk it all to get the whistleblowers out there and to get the stories out there that really do expose government wrongdoing. So it was an incredible to sit down with him, a little bit surreal to do it in the New York Times office, but very nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an unbelievable story. And I mean, maybe the craziest part about it, I mean, and you alluded to this is essentially par for the course in the Obama administration. I mean, they have been the harshest on whistleblowers of anyone ever, I guess, if I'm reading it correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Espionage Act was just this bizarre piece of legislation that we didn't really hear about. And then Obama just comes out full force. And I think the most bizarre thing about it is that everyone looked at Obama and he touted himself as the most transparent president, the most transparent administration. It's not only with this Espionage Act thing, but it's really just, you know, media in general, especially FOIA requests, which is really funny because they basically like have issued no, like every FOIA request that has been granted has only come back like half filled or like, you know, a lot of it's redacted and stuff. So it's just kind of this mirage, this illusion of transparency when really on the back end, it's actually the most aggressively cracking down on media whistleblowers and the like.
Right, right. I mean, Obama's putting all sorts of stuff. I mean, when they were even putting out the initial legal justification for the drone strikes and some of those other things, they were citing Nixon invading Cambodia. I mean, it really is almost like a parallel universe where Obama has this reputation for being the most progressive president. I mean, I don't know about ever, but everyone is like on, okay, yeah, he did the best he can. But then you look at a lot of these things, and I mean, if that's the best he can, then I mean, we got to put a pretty big black mark next to his name, I think, on some of these issues, right?
Yeah, I mean, he has been doing a lot of like token measures because I think he's kind of frantically about to leave office with like a super milquetoast record. I mean, you know, there was some sort of schism with him and the neocons that I think he did kind of prevent us from going all out bonkers in Syria and a couple other things. But of course, they punished him for that. And he just has been a horrible president. I mean, he's done nothing. He gave up his first 2 years with total control, majority in Congress. And, you know, at the end of the day, he has been the first American president that has spent his entire two full terms at constant war, Eugene, more than any other president. So that's going to be his legacy to me, and also not prosecuting torturers, war criminals, and just continuing to be a war criminal himself.
I mean, it does seem like the higher you go in American politics, the more immune you are. It's like, okay, you torture people with the CIA, you're good. You're a big bank, you destroyed the whole world economy, like, you're good. We're going to leave. I mean, what is going on in this situation? I mean, it just seems unbelievable that, like, the people committing the biggest crimes are actually getting off the freest.
Two-tier justice system, baby. Two-tier justice. Yeah, we just saw The Big Short the other day. For the first time, I finally understand the mortgage crisis. And I was like, wow, $5 trillion lost, 6 million homeless. I mean, $5 trillion is how much we spent on the entire war on terror so far. That's even kind of an overestimation. And can you imagine? $5 trillion just gone in the blink of an eye. Not one banker in jail. Mm-hmm. Not one banker in jail. Not one torturer in jail. Not one war architect in jail. In fact, they're all over the media selling the next war. It is insane.
I mean, it really is. And I wonder, you know, obviously we know that mainstream media isn't giving it to us in America. It's six major companies. But, you know, with the rise of you know, venues like YouTube, where I know you get a lot of views and where a lot of people now are just going with the independent journalism, I mean, do you see some hope that, you know, the media landscape may be fracturing or whatever, but these new media tools can get more of this stuff out there?
Of course, of course. And we see that in poll after poll, that the youth is completely tuning out corporate media. They know that they can't get their information from there, and they're totally tuning into alternative media, alternative sources. That's why people are going to Sputnik, to RT, to Telesur, which is where I work. These are great alternatives, but also the tons of citizen journalism, this renaissance and revolution of just indie media, blogs, and really the fact that everyone has the tools at their dispense, that they can just all access these and create blogs, create radio, create podcasts, and really report on the ground, tell the truth as they see it. And for the first time, I think history is no longer being written by the victors. It's being written real time by the people who see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that certainly that is, something that's certainly, I don't know, hopeful in some degree from my perspective. And, not that I want to promote whatever, corporate electronics, but now you can get so much good equipment relatively cheaply that people really, I think, are starting to feel a little bit more empowered behind their ability to affect the media landscape.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, smartphones, you have these apps now that, I mean, basically just film cops, film any injustice as you see it. And that's really the most dangerous tool to them. More dangerous than a gun sometimes is a camera.
I can believe that. And I think we're going to have to leave it there. I think that's a great way to leave it, though. And we are out of time for today's show. And you were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to all our guests. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.